This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff wants the U.S. to have wider authority. And AIDS and Black America. Joining us from our Chicago Bureau today is Roland Martin, Executive Editor of the Chicago Defender. On the line from Cape Cod, Mary Frances Berry, Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle, joins us from Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee. Folks, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it. Let's talk a little bit about the International AIDS Conference Summit that's going on in Toronto as we speak, and what we heard from African-American leaders there, Julian Bond and Jesse Jackson most notably, is a call that Black America needs to face the facts that AIDS has become a Black disease, no longer, Mary Frances Berry, can you label it a gay disease or something else? They say Black America needs to look in the mirror.
And the problem is, no matter what Julian and Jesse do, and certainly all of us should do everything we could, we have on the other side the religious, the church problem. In our churches, we have all these arguments about same-sex marriage and homophobia and people who still think AIDS somehow is connected with sin, and homosexuals who are giving out a completely different message. And we have our priorities wrong in our community. And so we focus on all of these things that are irrelevant to what we're trying to do instead of focusing on what we are trying to do. And we talk about people being on the down low and this and that and the other instead of getting on with the business of trying to do something. So I think Julian and Jesse and all of us, whatever agenda we can put out there to try to change people's attitudes, that's good. But somehow we need to get these mega churches with people raising holy hands and going back and forth. Some of them are doing something. I know a couple who are. But the rest of them, the churches, need to get involved in this too.
Roland Martin, I'm not sure why Black America has not received this message. We have been talking about it, those of us who have a pulpit and others have been talking about it for now a decade or more, and it just seems it's falling on deaf ears for some reason. Even educated folks don't have the full message here.
Well, primarily because there are so many different things tied up into this. If you approach it from a healthcare perspective, that is a different ball game, as opposed to the issue of, like in the case of Bill Duke, who recently directed a documentary where he did it because he found out his goddaughter, she was HIV infected. She was living with a man, married to him 12 years. 10 of those years, he was sleeping with another man. So you have that particular issue. You have the healthcare issue. You have the choice issue of people making personal decisions. So there are all kind of issues tied up there, but I think you have to approach it from a healthcare standpoint. That has to be the approach. Otherwise, you are going to get mired in this whole issue of lifestyle, of choice. Is it a matter of who's gay, who's on the down low? It has to be a healthcare discussion.
Jeff, how do you make it a healthcare discussion outside of giving the sheer numbers? We've talked about it again for decades. Half of all the new HIV cases that we see are from the African-American community. We see that it is now the leading cause of death for Black women between the ages of 25 to 34, on and on and on. I'm not sure how you shake people.
Well, you know, when you quote those numbers, it makes us have to finally face the fact that AIDS is no longer just the big green ogre in the room that everybody's ignoring, but it's become the room. We're finding it to be a prison, and it's framed by walls of ignorance and guilt, silence, apathy. And if we're not careful and vigilant, we're going to find ourselves and our children on death row. I think there needs to be a balance between the health care perspective approach and what I believe Jesse and Julian are talking about as a civil rights response. And that touches on something that Professor Berry said. How do you have a civil rights response to a disease that people don't see as a civil rights issue? By that I mean, in the civil rights era, people flooded into the churches, and the churches were a grassroots center for doing things. And people in church, I'll say from a clergy perspective, they don't want to talk about AIDS in a lot of churches because it makes them have to discuss people's lifestyle. And that lifestyle could be being gay, being bisexual, or having sex. Three things that people in church just don't do. We don't do those things in church. So people don't want to bring them up and talk about them.
But we do them, though. But we do.
I know, I said it tongue-in-cheek.
We are hypocrites. That's right. Add hypocrisy to what you said, Jeff.
Yeah, indeed.
Hey, Ed,
it is.
Ed, I have to jump.
Go ahead.
Mary made a point about the megachurches. First of all, megachurches only comprise 4% of churches in the country. A megachurch is those churches exceeding 2,000. The problem really is that your megachurches, most of your megachurches have major AIDS ministries. The problem are your churches where they are 100, 200, and 500 members. That's where your real problem is, because they are not the ones who are on the front line involved with the Balm of Gilead, other kind of organizations dealing with the AIDS issue. That's really where the problem is. The smaller churches who choose not to deal with these topics, who do not have major ministries that are able to confront the issue. I think we have to stop dancing around and hit folks in the head. And very simply, is your son, your daughter, your uncles, your aunts, your mothers and fathers, they are going to die of AIDS unless you change behavior, unless we begin to practice safe sex. As long as we try to couch it in nice church terms where you don't want to confront people, you have to get right in their face on this particular issue. You have no choice.
Here's what's interesting, Jeff, and I'll let you pick up on that point, but I want you to address what Reverend Jackson said in a statement released there. He says, but we being the black community, have also been a complaint victim, submitting through interaction. It's now time for us to fight AIDS like the major civil rights issue it is. And we've seen the U.S. black delegation from the International AIDS Conference here pledge to draft a 5-year plan to reduce HIV rates among African Americans. Do you see it as a major civil rights issue, and can you fight it that way?
Yeah, I think you can fight it that way. I think you have to fight it through activism, education and activism. And I would say that there's a take that I have on that whole mega church perspective. I've traveled around a lot of mega churches, spoken at small churches. It's a tricky thing, 4% of the churches, but a lot of the concentration of the population, especially in urban area, go to these large churches. And the AIDS programs that are there, a lot of times those large churches see that as outreach. So the outreach is for those AIDS people out there in the community, and not for the people in our church who might be affected or infected. So I think we have to realize that AIDS is inside the family. It's inside the family of the church. In some of the small and medium-sized churches, they're still preaching some of the, I guess you could say, the right-wing philosophy that would say you can't stand up and direct a choir. You can't be in the choir if you're overly effeminate. In the larger churches, there's a lot more guys who come who are overly effeminate, who are marrying off people in marriage and singles ministry, and AIDS is being transmitted there, but people are seeing AIDS as outside of the church. So I think all fairness, we have to fix that across the board by just putting it on the table and say, gay, straight, lesbian, whatever you are, this is a disease that's killing us, and we're just going to have to be frank and say that we need the ministry for ourselves inside and outside of churches.
But how do you cast it as a civil rights issue? People historically have a different perspective when you use the phrase civil rights. I think you're going to spend a significant amount of time trying to cast it as a civil rights issue when people don't think of that in terms of civil rights. This is a life or death issue. And so you're going to spend lots of time trying to brand it as a civil rights issue, and as opposed to confronting the issue. Mary,
I think civil rights leaders can help to deal with it, but I agree with you that it's not fundamentally a civil rights issue. I think Jesse, and I think Julian, and I think all of the people in the country who aspire to being leaders should go around to all of the church conferences that take place, the Baptists, all the little churches are there, speak about this issue from the heart, get people to see it the way Jeff was talking about it and you were talking about it, Roland, as an issue that is poisoning our community. Talk about sex to them in terms they can understand. Have the courage to do that. Meet with ministers and try to get ministers. We need a movement to get ministers to have that issue in their church. And finally, I want to just say this about this. Jeff, you were talking about the effeminate men and the whatever in the church and so on. If two kinds of people didn't go to church on Sunday, the black church would close. If there were no black women going, we all decided not to go to church. Okay?
Indeed.
And if gay men decided not to go to church,
indeed,
the choir wouldn't be singing, the choir director half the time wouldn't be there, and sometimes a preacher. So we ought to stop being hypocritical about this and bring it home.
All right. That'd be a lonely structure, Mary. You're right about that.
You're right.
All right, Jeff, let me move on very quickly to something else. I'm sure we'll continue to tackle this as we have continuously, and that is the deadline for signing up for the congressional seat for embattled Rep of Louisiana William Jefferson ended last Friday. We're seeing a number of people challenge Representative Jefferson, but I wanted to open this up to a larger question. When we see Jefferson in danger of losing his seat, and he's already lost his seat as a member of the Ways and Means Committee, when we see Charlie Rangel talking about possible retirement, when we see Cynthia McKinney going down to defeat Roland Martin, when you look at the power of the Congressional Black Caucus and blacks on Capitol Hill, one has to take a look at this election as a possible sea change for what we have known for years.
Well, of course. Well, go ahead, Jeff. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm saying the power of the Congressional Black Caucus in recent years, that might be an oxymoron. But we haven't really found that people speak up. And when you talk about Charlie Rangel retiring, he's one of the people who has spoken up. Cynthia McKinney is one of the people that has spoken up. I think you're seeing a bit of a power shift there. I think 12 challengers that are facing Jefferson, I think that helps him more than it hurts him. I think that if he can keep his core base, he's not going to worry about that. I'll get out
first
of the
of all, I think on the issue of power, I mean, the reality, Ed, is that members of Congress do many things we don't even see to understand their power in terms of placing appropriations and bills and things along those lines. What you're losing is you're losing significant amounts of experience. Congress is based upon how many years you're there. And so on one hand, people talk about we need new leadership, but one of the reasons you become powerful is because you've been there 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years. I mean, the reality is we are seeing many of our lions and lionesses, we're seeing them leaving primarily because they're getting old. And so you've had members of Congress leave over the last several years who are African-American because they've been there 20, 25, 30 years. This is a natural transition. You simply don't have, for African-Americans, the same sort of situation where someone who is white who is in Congress, they may stay there 10, 12 years and leave. No, our folks have been there 25, 30 years. So this is going to be natural. In the case of Jefferson, he simply got 12 challengers because he's under the eye of the Justice Department. That's why. If that wasn't the case, he would win with little challengers.
Well, Mary, where Roland is right is that you do see power accumulated by a number of years, and the more you stay on Capitol Hill, the more you understand and know the game. But I don't know that I agree with him totally on the white side in terms of people staying. There are many white officials who stay till they die in office. While we don't expect necessarily Charlie Rangel or John Conyers or others to do that is certainly their choice. We are having to face the idea that many of those lion and lionesses, as Roland has so aptly described them as, are going to have to indeed make decisions as to whether they want to stay on longer or, in fact, concede power. And often in private conversations, they feel that they're letting the community down in doing so.
I think Charlie Rangel leaving would be a major loss, whether or not the Democrats win, because of all the things. He's got clout.
Right.
I think John Conyers should stay as long as he can until he becomes chair of the judiciary. I think that Jefferson is in a different category. I've always been fond of him and admired his expertise on the Hill, but his own caucus, Democratic caucus, hasn't permitted him to exercise the function of on Ways and Means. They have stopped dealing with him. They had done the same thing with Cynthia McKinney. Pelosi hardly spoke to her. I'm not sure she even spoke to her before she left when she got with that thing with the Capitol policeman, even though she wasn't convicted of anything. I don't think the grand jury even indicted her. So that Charlie Rangel leaving would be a big loss. If Jefferson is acquitted and wins, then his seniority will still mean something. But I can see why the challengers are there, and it may be time for somebody new to be down there to represent the people in New Orleans, because Jeff can't exercise the kind of clout that he used to in the Congress. But I think Charlie Rangel leading, I mean, that would be a terrible loss.
Mm-hmm. All right. But we've got to accept the reality that if you're 69, 70, 71 years old,
there's no doubt about that, Rome.
You want to do more things with your life.
I mean, you would hope so.
I mean, we'll be kind of selfish. So
let me quickly get to something, Jeff, and I'll have you kick this off if we might. And what I call surveillance envy, and that's Michael Chertoff, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, is calling for a review of laws allowing more electronic surveillance and detention of possible terror suspects, based on what he is seeing, and of course with last week's foiled plot. Many are suggesting that he's seen the wider authority that British leaders have to apprehend suspects, and that he wants the same in the United States. Yet there is a concern by many, minorities in particular, that this wider authority could in fact infringe on civil rights that we have seen diminish since 9/11.
I think so, and I want to make this clear. We are losing the war on terror, and badly. I'll say that because terror is fear. We live in fear. Fear does three things. It paralyzes, it makes you lose consciousness, or it makes you flee. We're paralyzed as a society right now. We're not even, there hasn't been a major incident like 9/11 since 9/11, but we are walking and living in fear. We're changing the way we're living. We're doing security. We're doing different things because we're paralyzed. We've lost consciousness as a population. We're asleep, and we're running from the real issue. And that is, how do we live in a global community, getting along with others and getting along with ourselves, by not turning the U.S. into a police state? We're going to flee to those who promise safety, including the Big Brother mentality.
All right, Roland, with you and Mary splitting about 45 seconds.
45 seconds. We've got the gang that can't shoot straight, Chertoff, at the top, with all of these different rules about things. And a report came out this morning that the screeners taking off your shoes and all that stuff, it came out in TSA. It doesn't do any good. So the gang that can't shoot straight at all is in charge. Arresting the wrong people, being late with everything, putting out rules that don't make any sense, and that just compounds the problem of changes in our way of life that Jeff was talking about.
Very Roland. Simply, Ed, we don't have the confidence in our government that we had after 9/11. They have squandered that moral authority, and we will be very leery of providing more, taking more of our liberties away for this by virtue of that. That's why it's going to be difficult.
And, Jeff, there's no question. I think you hit the nail on the head with the idea of if, in fact, winning the war on terror is reducing fear. We are not seeing that in this country. All right, Mary, Roland, Jeff, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it, guys.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.